Schools versus CPC. Mr. Tobin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Tobin. I am one of the attorneys for Brenda Helms, who's a Chapter 7 trustee in her capacity as an appellant in case 081017. Our case is perhaps a little more mundane than the one you just heard. It's a uniform commercial.
Well, actually, no. And it's I found the briefing extremely confusing. And with the permission of my colleagues, I'd like you and the other lawyers to structure your argument as follows. And we've enlarged the time you have, so you'd be able to add anything you want. But now first, as we understand it, the first issue involves this $88,000 settlement with the, what do you call this, insurance broker, should we call him? What's Rothschild?
Rothschild is a broker. It's a malpractice.
A broker, plan. Okay. They have a settlement with the insurance broker. So the question is, can that amount be considered proceeds of collateral for the loan to Certified? Proceeds of collateral consisting of an insurance policy. So the insurance policy, because of Rothschild's negligence, didn't cover the facility where the collateral was damaged. But is the question whether, nevertheless, that insurance policy can be considered collateral, part of the collateral. And if so, then CPCA would be entitled to the $88,000. The second issue has to do with these business interruption losses that Certified is claiming against ComEd. So it's asking ComEd or suing ComEd for $2 million, $200,000 for the actual physical damage to the collateral. That seems fine. And then $1.8 million for the business interruption costs that ComEd's negligence imposed. Now, the contract between LaSalle or LaSalle's predecessor, whatever it is, between the lender and Certified doesn't actually expressly confer on LaSalle a security interest in Certified's commercial tort claims, although there's a reference to commercial tort claims. And the question is, or questions are, so this failure to confer expressly a security interest in this suit by Certified against ComEd, can this nevertheless be considered a contractual entitlement of LaSalle and therefore CPCA on various grounds? One possibility, the failure of the express conferral was a forgivable unilateral mistake by Certified or by LaSalle, and that would be the doctrine of the Falconbridge case, which you discuss. Or it could be this omission in the contract would be cured by the composite document rule. Or maybe it's immaterial because the contract granted LaSalle the right to unilaterally add collateral in Schedule B. Indeed, there's even a question, well, maybe it still can, right, because it's unilateral. So these are issues, you know, we're interested in and want you to address. And then after you do that, if you want to add anything else, obviously, you'll have time.
Your Honor, let me take the first question that you posed. The $88,000, is it proceeds? And that would be under UCC Section 102A64. And the district court addressed that, and there's five subsections of that provision. A, B, and C, the district court, and I think we agree, certainly don't apply, so that leaves D and E. The $88,000, of course, did not come into existence until after the trustee's judgment lien attached to the commercial tort claim. So that makes it different than Wiersma. Our citation was served before.
Why does that make a difference? Suppose you had a simple proceeds case, collateral destroyed and replaced by insurance proceeds.
Then I think it's simple. Then E controls.
No, simple, wouldn't care, and that would relate back.
Right.
Right. Okay. So forget that.
Their
argument, as I understand it, is that this insurance policy was, it was botched. It was botched by Rothschild, and Rothschild now has paid. And in the settlement, probably not pay everything, but made a settlement that this should be treated as proceeds. It's just an indirect way of getting the proceeds.
Well,
because it was LaSalle's intention and Certified's intention that there would be insurance that would be part of the collateral.
Right. There's no doubt that there was an intention that there would be insurance. The problem is that there was no insurance.
I understood your argument actually to focus on one word that Judge Posner just uttered, and that's the word indirect, because I thought you were almost making a remoteness argument. Normally in professional malpractice situations, whether it's legal malpractice or insurance malpractice, if you're bringing a legal malpractice action, then you try this little case within a case and you figure out what would the result have been in the case that was botched, and you figure out, the contract would have been defended against or whatever it may be, and then you kind of take that back out to the malpractice case, and that becomes the measure of damages in the malpractice case. And I understood CPCA's argument to be exactly that is happening here. You had the insurance broker's negligence that gets looked at within the case. We find out what the result would have been had the insurance broker not been negligent. There would have been coverage on this other piece of property, and we plug that back in. So why is that too remote?
Well, I think the court decided that issue in 1986 in Schmalen. Here was a situation where there was no direct link between the damage to the bank's collateral.
So what would be the bad effect of...
It doesn't arise out of it. I mean, you got to look at...
No, that's worse. Sorry. What is the bad effect of treating these as proceeds?
The bad effect? The bad effect is I think you'd be disregarding the plain language of the Uniform
Commercial
Code.
Well, is there some notice problem? In bankruptcy, people need to be able to see what's out there. Is there notice to third parties? Is there some possible difference in the measure of damages? I think those are
Let's talk about it. Let's say that there a third-party creditor came and said, I see a financing statement on file. It covers commercial tort claims. Mr. Banker, would you please send me the security agreement so I see, what commercial tort claims we're talking about? Lo and behold, they get the security agreement. They look through it, and there's no commercial tort claims listed. Now, we all know that the UCC looks at commercial tort claims differently than inventory or accounts receivable. You can't just use a category in the description. Section 108 of the UCC says you have to define them specifically.
But if the only commercial tort claim is to replace damaged collateral, why is that any different from this third-party creditor would know that LaSalle had an interest in the collateral and the proceeds of the collateral?
They wouldn't know.
What difference would it, pardon?
They wouldn't know from looking at the security agreement.
Well, they know that LaSalle has an interest in the collateral.
Yes, but they know
that that covers proceeds if the collateral is damaged.
Right.
So what difference does it make to that creditor whether those proceeds would be pursuant to an insurance policy or pursuant to a tort claim because the insurance policy had been botched by someone?
Because the UCC...
Why wouldn't that be a windfall to that creditor? Says, hey, great, I thought they, of course, they'd insure the collateral. They didn't, so terrific.
Well, they would have a claim to proceeds of the hard assets that were covered and properly perfected. The security interest never attached to the commercial tort claim.
Are we talking about the second part of the case or the 88,000 right
That's
now?
The, well, actually both, but the, I was really here to address more of the 88,000.
So the 88,000, that's, okay, maybe I was confused. So the 88,000, that's a business interruption loss.
No, that's a that's a settlement.
No, but it's part of the business interruption losses. It's not part of the damage to the collateral, is it?
That's, well, it's a mil.
200,000.
I believe the 88,000 represents the liability for the malpractice. The insurance carriers
of
are
of course I know
failure.
That, but what is that 88,000? Is that
it's not hard assets. In other words, it's not hard assets.
Malpractice was the failure to have the business loss policy cover the facility where the collateral was.
That's correct.
Right? Okay.
That's correct.
Okay. So, but again, the question is if that. Insurance. So, is there no reference in the loan agreement to is this the same loan agreement that's involved in the $2 million part of the case?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So,
there's only one loan agreement.
Well, suppose we decided that LaSalle had a good claim to the $2 million. Wouldn't that decide the 88,000 also?
It would depend on your logic, but I think you're right.
Yeah. So essentially, I see. But the difference is that you're. Okay, that makes it a little clear. So if I understand correctly, it's really two commercial tort claims. One was the one settled with Rothschild. The other is the one, pending one with ComEd.
That's correct.
So really they should be decided the same way.
Right, and the district court decided them exactly, you know, different, which we said there was an internal inconsistency in the district court's decision. And the district court did not consider, I think.
So you want it all decided?
Oh, yes, in our favor, absolutely, Your Honor. We want the district court affirmed on the business interruption claim against ComEd, and of course we would like the $88,000 as well on the same logic and the same principles, that the lien never attached to the commercial tort claim, which is a special kind of category of collateral. It can't even be after acquired property under the UCC. So the UCC is very plain that in order to get a lien or a security interest in a commercial tort claim, it has to be a current security agreement that describes what the claim is.
And the point of this, when you know, I've been trying to think through from some time ago, because when you go about perfecting that security interest, you're filing things somewhere. There are third-party interests involved that you may not have, as we did in the Falconridge case or other kinds of cases. Somebody else has to know whether this is encumbered.
That's right. And the way they would do is they'd get the financing statement. They see commercial tort claims. They say to the bank is good enough to send them a security agreement. Send me the security agreement. Let me see exactly what your collateral is. And I want to see what these commercial tort claims are. They look at Schedule B. Lo and behold, it's blank.
Schedule B being blank is a problem, not for the parties themselves, but for somebody else.
That's, well, for the parties themselves as well, because there was no lien created at the time the agreement was.
Wouldn't they see in the loan agreement that that LaSalle had the right to unilaterally add to Schedule B?
If they saw the amendments, yes, but LaSalle never did that.
No, I understand, but what?
They would have a right to say, but LaSalle hasn't done it yet, so I don't see anything else that's encumbered.
That's correct. In other words, LaSalle didn't take. They had an option, but they didn't exercise their option.
But they could at any time. So if you're
a third party's. I mean, after a third party loans or extends credit.
If a third party sees a notice which says that. There are no commercial tort claims yet, but the creditor can add them unilaterally with no deadline. Why doesn't that put that creditor on notice?
It does that in the future. Should LaSalle decide to add that to their collateral package, they can do it.
Why
can't
they add it now?
Because the third party's rights have intervened. They've cut it off. LaSalle can't just basically take away third party's rights.
What third party are you talking about?
Well, we happen to be a judgment lien creditor. We're a trustee in bankruptcy. We happen to have a judgment. We got a citation served. So we have a judgment lien creditor. So we have rights in the commercial tort claims.
But you're not a I thought the purpose of the, you know, the UCC registry is to provide notice to someone else who would be considering lending money to certified. And if that someone else sees in the loan agreement that that LaSalle has a right to add commercial tort claims, you know, as they arise to Schedule B, doesn't that give that?
No, because the Uniform Commercial Code specifically says commercial tort claims can't be after acquired property, cannot be. It's one of the only things that it can't be. So if it can't be after acquired a property, it has to be in existence at the time, or the third party can extend credit safely, with the expectation that it would have a prior security interest or lien on the commercial tort claims. So that's why they can do it.
There's no one in that position, right?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of. So, yeah, I mean, that's right. They didn't.
So what's the harm? Why? I don't understand.
The harm, I guess, is that the way the UCC was drafted, you're not supposed to do it that way. It's like what's the harm of not?
People are always screwing up with drafting.
But so that's how
what difference
trustees make their living, you know. I mean, you don't properly perfect, you know, what's the real harm. But you addressed that kind of in Schmaling. You know, you said in Schmaling, and that was the payment in kind program, the program payments, there's an economic justification for doing that, for substituting the PIC payment programs for the crops. But that's not really what we do, because the economic justification doesn't make it a legal justification. And by the way, the lender in that situation could have expanded its collateral description to get a general intangible and could have perfected himself. LaSalle could have done the same thing here, but LaSalle chose not to, or didn't do it. I don't know if they chose, but they didn't do it for whatever reason. So if we just want to say we don't have to comply with technical UCC requirements and there's really no harm, no foul, well, I suppose you're right, because nobody, and I'm not going to stand here and tell you differently, there's nobody that relied upon that financing statement and looked at it. Those aren't the facts of our case. I wish I had them, but I don't. So I don't want to try to fool you on that. The second thing, Your Honor, I think you made reference to the Vic Supply case or Falcon Bridge. And that, of course, was a little bit different because there the contract, the security agreement, required the bank's signature to be effective. But the UCC didn't. The UCC said that doesn't matter as long as the debtor signs. Well, here we have exactly the opposite. Here we have a situation where the UCC says the bank actually has to do what the bank failed to do, despite the party's contract. Because what their argument is, we gave them notice, but notice isn't sufficient to create a security interest. The bank actually had to do something to amend the security agreement so that third parties, if they asked to see the security agreement and the extent of the bank's collateral, would know specifically what it is. So I hope, Your Honor, that I've answered those questions. Actually, my colleague, Mr. Gavaya, who I don't know how much time we have left, but was actually going to argue the cross appeal. He had actually done the trial court below in the district court. I don't know if.
Okay. Does their side have more time? They were going to divide the argument.
Yeah.
So your side has four minutes or five?
Oh, 4 minutes.
So you can use some of it now or leave it all for rebuttal.
I'm going to leave it for rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tolan. Mr. Schindler?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Ralph Schindler on behalf of CPC Acquisition. Your Honor, as you know, we stand in the shoes of LaSalle Bank, and it's our position that the interest in both the $88,000, the Rothschild settlement, and in the Commonwealth Edison action constitute proceeds of collateral.
They're really the same issue, aren't they?
Your Honor, I was surprised that there was a decision one way and not the other way as to one collateral. And I mean, we were successful in the Rothschild. Well, actually, first we lost both issues, and then the district court, Judge Lindbergh, gave us the Rothschild but then didn't give us the Commonwealth Edison on the business interruption part, and it seems inconsistent to go one way on one and a different way on the other. Except I can understand it in this regard, because the 88,000, our argument was that, well, the proof of damages is the damage to our machinery and equipment, our raw materials and our inventory.
So could I clarify that? Because when we were talking about what that $88,000 was, I thought it might be helpful to back up and say what would have been the insurance recovery if the policy had properly been written to cover that.
Your Honor, we didn't take part in the settlement of that claim, but the claim was for the entire.
But bear with me. I mean, as I understand it, your theory is that the professional malpractice judgment, which happens to have been a settlement, but that doesn't matter, is the same thing as what would have happened if the broker had properly done his job. And so moving back, I thought that that $88,000 did represent tangible things, not business interruption.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So
that's
it's
my
not
understanding.
A business interruption
matter. It was actually originally $100,000.
So bricks and mortar or machines or?
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. It was the $100,000, the limits of his errors and omission policy, I believe, is what was settled. So his errors and omission policy gave the $100,000. There was a $12,000 attorney lien that they settled, resulting in the 88.
But your theory has to be that $100,000 or 88, whichever you want to call it, is something that is functionally equivalent to the proceeds insurance recovery that would have come your way had the policy properly been written to begin with.
That's correct,
the
Your
only
Honor.
Theory and under which you would
well,
you
know, and also
call
if you,
it proceeds, and I wasn't sure whether the measure of damages is necessarily the same. And your opponent does also make an argument to say, you know, how far out do you go? You know, what?
Well, if we look
at
the statute, it says claims arising out of the loss or damage to the collateral.
But I mean, you can play all sorts of games with the words arising out of. The broker could have been negligent. It might not have done anything to
But again, as long as the proof of damages is you damage my collateral.
Well, there could have been a different exception in the insurance policy. So even though he was negligent and failed to include that property, maybe there was employee gross negligence and thus there was
But
no
again, I think the facts of this case were that he didn't have the correct address on the insurance policy, though the insurance company denied coverage.
Mr. Tobin says that the $88,000 is in respect of business losses, not the physical damage to the equipment in the factory.
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor. I believe the $88,000,
Imagine a more basic yes and no question than this. How come you can't agree with your opponent on that? What does the insurance policy say?
It was an errors and omissions policy.
Well, that's the perfect. We're talking about two insurance policies, aren't we? Aren't we talking about the
no.
error?
No, there's only one insurance policy.
Just the one insurance policy.
The only thing that we lost on was the business interruption portion.
That's the
But
comment
it's the broker's
part.
Policy of errors and
well,
omissions.
Yes.
It's not the policy that he failed to include
that's
the address
That's what I'm
on.
Trying to get at, exactly.
Maybe I don't understand it, but there were two claims. One was the error or omission. It all arose out of the fire. The fire was the damage to all the collateral. And
that's the thing, that insurance doesn't cover this property because of the mistake on the address, right?
And what was that insurance policy on the property that didn't cover this facility where the fire
Well, occurred? If you look in the P exhibits, there's a certificate of insurance, okay? And LaSalle had insurance, or at least thought it had insurance, on all the raw material inventory, work in process, finished goods inventory, machinery and equipment. It was a rental premises.
Did that include any business interruption?
Yes, and business interruption.
Okay, so this $88,000, is this for the for the damage to the property or for the interruption of the business?
It wasn't specified, Your Honor. It was for the loss, the fire loss. It was for the failure to ensure the correct location. The proof of damages of which was I lost $1 million or $2 million worth of from the fire.
Right, and that's why I'm concerned about equating the professional negligence recovery with what would have been the recovery under a properly drafted insurance policy? Because it sounds to me like maybe the recovery under a properly drafted insurance policy might have been considerably more than that.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the definition of collateral, and it's in the appendix here, A1, the definition of collateral in the security agreement says that it does cover proceeds of all insurance policy insuring the foregoing property.
But the professional negligence policy is not an insurance policy insuring the property. That insures the broker from all of his clients and all of, you know, everything he does.
But again, the proof of the claim, in other words, I wouldn't get $1 unless...
They're not unrelated in this case, believe me, or we wouldn't be here. But the question is, how far do you take this collateral? Do you say, and also unrelated insurance policies that happen to cover professionals who deal with, you know, suppose you had a patent agent filing, you know, on a patent application. I assume that would come under this language, too. Or you have... you know, a franchise or something. You've got all sorts of things in there.
But, Your Honor, I think Judge Lindberg, we would contend, got it correct. And the only issue remaining in terms of LaSalle's success on this matter is whether the business interruption component should be considered proceeds. And we would contend based on...
To make sure we understand it correctly. So this 88, suppose that there was $1 damage to the prop, to the equipment, but it was such a critical piece of equipment that the factory was shut down. So it had $1 in property damage and $87,999 in the lost profits from the interruption of the business. That's one case. The second case, $1 of lost profits, $87,999 of physical damage. As I understand your position, the settlement, the $88,000, would have been identical in both cases because the insurance that Rothschild was supposed to get would have covered both the damage to the property and the interruption of the business. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But, and again, our argument would be that we are entitled to both of those as proceeds.
Well, I think my own view would be you would be entitled to the physical part of it. You wouldn't be entitled to the business interruption.
Well, the problem, Your Honor, I mean...
Because the business interruption is taking proceeds too far. Because that there you end up with proceeds that are going to be greater than the collateral. That doesn't make any sense. How can the proceeds, of collateral exceed the value of the collateral?
That's the Rainier case, Your Honor. I mean...
The Rainier. Look, how can the proceeds of the collateral exceed the collateral? What sense does that make? Your property is destroyed, and you get proceeds. You lose $10,000 of proceeds. So you lose $10,000 of property. You have $1 million in business interruption, and you want to treat the $1 million as proceeds of the destruction of $10,000 worth of collateral. That doesn't make any sense. That is your position, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. I think.
Well, that's no good. That can't be right.
Well, Your Honor, if you read the statute, it says rights arising out of collateral.
Move on to the next, the $1.8 million. Now, your opponent has made a powerful argument that, bankruptcy trustees, they exploit every technicality in the law. That's what they do. It's very obnoxious. But he's saying that that this contract could not create a security interest in these commercial tort claims because Schedule B was left blank. Now, what's your answer to that?
Well, I'm happy to have both of you on the panel because you were the authors of the Falconbridge case. So our answer is basically Falconbridge. I think it was an omission.
No, he said Falconbridge, the missing link, the defect was a missing signature, and the UCC said that didn't matter.
Well, let's back up to the point in time in which that signature was missing, because if you go back in time... First of all,
I'd rather hear about this case than about Falconbridge. Now, he said that you can't create a lien in a commercial tort claim unless you've specified the tort claim.
Your Honor,
is that right or wrong?
I think we have specified the tort claim.
So he's right that you have to specify it, but you say you have specified.
Well, I think we can go to the composite document.
Specification.
We can go to the other items. LaSalle had the right to amend Schedule B at any time, provided we give notice of the claim. And the record is replete
with
all notices.
You gave notice to the other party, and then you also want somebody to root around in all the documents that LaSalle has in his files. But in UCC contexts, there has to be some transparency. That's the system.
It's right here, UCC 1, a public filing. It says commercial tort claims right here on the UCC 1.
But then we come to the special rules for commercial tort claims. Somebody says, oh, I'm thinking of loaning money to certified. Wonder what they've got out there. You know, what kind of collateral can I get? And they go look and they say, oh, there aren't any commercial tort claims listed right now. So I'm good to go with
Well, first of all,
loan.
That never happened. They never actually went there.
I know it didn't, but the whole system of UCC filing is what's at stake here, and people need to have the ability to check that, and if after acquired property can be included, then it is, and it often is with different kinds of things, but if it can't be included or after acquired commercial tort claims, that's a different situation. So just because nobody happened to come along doesn't answer this case.
Yes, Your Honor, but again, if we look at the security agreement, 615 of the security agreement, it says borrower shall notify.
Where are you now?
The actual security agreement between certified and LaSalle.
Is that this group exhibit G in the appendix? Amended security agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. Paragraph 6.15. And if I may read it for the court. Borrower has no commercial tort claims.
What page of the agreement is it on? Is that page 4?
Your Honor, it's on page 5. In the white appendix, page 5.
What is the section then?
It's 6.15.
Right, okay.
Down at the bottom there, it says commercial tort claims. Borrower has no commercial tort claims pending other than those set forth on Schedule B hereto, as Schedule B may be amended from time to time. Borrower shall notify lender promptly upon becoming aware of any commercial tort claim of borrower, which may arise, which notice shall constitute borrower's authorization to amend Schedule B to add such commercial tort claim. And certified gave notice. So, again, like Falconbridge, ministerial act. They should have.
But here's where it's actually LaSalle that has the interest in, you know, eventually in getting Schedule B correct, because they're the ones who are going to keep loaning money, and they don't want to be junior in priority to somebody else who comes along in an intervening position.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, under what we would consider the composite document rule, they got the notice. I guess it would.
So then they just decided to run the risk of being junior, it looks like.
I don't think so. I think it was always their understanding that they had a security interest in that. The testimony at trial from Mr. Luttrell.
Why didn't LaSalle amend Schedule B?
Again, I don't know, Your Honor. It was in their loan file. I don't think they amended Schedule B. Again, if we go back in time, at the time that this Schedule B was executed, there was no commercial tort claim.
Of course, that's the whole
later. Of course, yeah.
The whole point.
So, but again, I think they were relying probably on the proceeds argument. So we have the proceeds argument, and then we also have this ability to amend it, and we also have the question of the composite document rule in terms of all the other notices that they received. Would that constitute an amendment? Again, the public filing listed commercial tort claims, so the public was on notice that there were a lien claimed against commercial tort claims, if any arose. So I don't see no harm, no foul in that regard.
That is the notice that the UCC requires, right? You have to notify, you have to give notice of the lien when it arises. What is a third party, a subsequent creditor, what's it supposed to do with a financing statement which says that that which mentions commercial liens and refers to Schedule B, and then he looks and there's no Schedule B. Why wouldn't he assume there are no liens?
I think had Mr. Tolman contacted LaSalle and said, I want to look at your security agreement, they certainly would have amended Schedule B before he looked at it. I'm sure that they would have gone through the file and say, whoops, we
What's
better correct
UCC
Schedule B.
What's in the UCC registry?
Pardon?
What's in the UCC registry?
In the UCC registry, there's a UCC-1 filing dated August 28, 2001, that specifically claims an interest in commercial tort claims and proceeds of all the foregoing.
And that's listed in Schedule B, though, doesn't it say, commercial tort claims?
This is just a UCC-1 financing statement. It calls for...
Where is that? Is that in your appendix?
That is in our supplemental appendix A1.
That's in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where's that?
That's in SA3, Supplemental Appendix 3, the second page.
I see. That's all you have to file. Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. So there was notice to the public that there was a claim.
So is it your view that this, that there's no duty to add anything to this?
It's our position that under the composite document, the notice that we gave, that Certified gave to LaSalle, gave them authority to amend Schedule B. We look at Falconbridge and say...
No, I'm looking at this financing statement. So if a creditor, a subsequent, would-be creditor, he reads this and he says, he sees all assets of the debtor and this and that and the other, that's not... very informative. So what is he supposed to do to discharge his duty of good faith inquiry?
Then contact LaSalle Bank and say, what do you have a security interest in? What is an unencumbered asset that I can lend against? Okay, and he's got notice here of all these assets that are being encumbered, and so he should then inquire, well, what is an unencumbered asset that I can loan against?
But that's where the specificity rules of the UCC for commercial tort claims would come into effect. LaSalle Bank wouldn't be able to say, well, in case there's ever a commercial tort claim, we have an interest against that. Don't they have to be specific?
Your Honor, I think at that point in time, if I wanted to make a loan against a commercial tort claim, I would have to specifically identify it. And the footnotes and the comments to the UCC talk about specifically identifying commercial tort claims, but it also says that proceeds may also constitute commercial tort claims. So it's not uncommon that a commercial tort claim can also be proceeds. And again, my time is just about up, but I would like to distinguish, I believe, the Schmalling case. As I understand, Schmalling... Judge Posner, you were on that case. There was a farmer had obtained a loan probably for feed and fertilizer and then proceeded to leave his land fallow and go into the payment in kind program. And the court ruled that there was, in fact, this was not proceeds, that it didn't follow into the collateral. That's totally different than our case. In Schmalling, we had a case where there was a loan. He was supposed to invest in collateral, plant the crop. The crop would grow, turn itself into corn, and then we would get that corn. And instead, there was a break in the chain of title. There was no continuation of that. I don't think the security interest ever attached in that case. So I think Schmalling is clearly distinguishable from this case, and this case falls more along the lines of State of Washington Supreme Court case, Rainier, where there was a collateral interest in a herd of dairy cows, and a loan made against that. The dairy cows, the farmer goes into the dairy termination program. He gets $672,000 for going into the dairy termination program. He slaughters all of his dairy herd. The bank gets the money back for the slaughter, but they don't get anything for the dairy termination program. And the Washington Supreme Court analyzed the same section and says, well, that's a right arising out of the collateral, and therefore you have a right as the bank to the $672,000. I think that's similar to this case in terms of the business interruption and all the other claims arising out of it, including the Rothschild claim, is that these are all proceeds. So our principal argument would be that the proceeds should be broadly construed. We believe the comment specifies that, and the case law indicates that it should be broadly construed. So based on that, we would ask that you affirm the district court as to the bulk of its ruling, but grant us the security interest in the business interruption component as well.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Schindler. Mr. Tobin or Mr. Gouveia?
Good morning, Gordon Gouveia. Thank you for allowing us to share this argument time, Your Honor. I'd like to start by addressing the issue that was first discussed by opposing counsel to clarify the record with respect to the $88,000. There were two insurance policies at issue, and the operative policy was the errors and omissions policy, the policy of the insurance.
We're not interested in that. The question is, what does that $88,000 cover?
It represents... The recovery represents business interruption losses. And the way that you can tell, you know that by looking at the complaint against Rothschild Agency. And I believe it's count four of that complaint is against the agency. The other counts are against the insurance companies. And in count four, Certified Packaging Corporation seeks recovery for business interruption losses. And that's the only way that you can decipher what this $88,000 represents, because it was a settlement of that claim. So I think the record is clear in that regard. With respect to the proceeds argument, as a general proposition, you have to look at the underlying collateral. And I think, Judge Posner, you were right on point where you say that the proceeds can't exceed the value of the collateral. And, in fact, the statute, revised Article 9, expressly says that proceeds is limited to the extent of the value of the collateral. And that's exactly right, which is why proceeds does not encompass the business interruption losses. And then finally, to touch briefly on the composite document theory, which is the alternate theory for perfection in commercial tort claims on which CPC acquisition relies, the composite document theory is a way to ascertain the party's intent to grant the security interest. That's not an issue here. We can't dispute that a Certified Packaging evidenced an intent to grant LaSalle a security interest, but the bottom line is they didn't take the next appropriate step. As Judge Wood observed, they didn't meet the sufficiency of description requirement that makes commercial tort claims special and different than other types of...
Perhaps this discussed in your brief. One of the things I find very confusing is most of the argument, most of the brief seemed to be about the $88,000.
Well, that was the issue.
It's dwarfed by the $1.8 million. But there's so little said about the $1.8 million.
Well, Judge, you also have to keep in mind that the $88,000 is money that's sitting in a trust account as opposed to a lawsuit that's still pending.
The $1.8 million is just a claim against ComEd.
It's a claim against ComEd that hasn't been litigated.
Fantasy money, monopoly money. Right.
That's certainly right. in the background.
Your co-counsel... placed a lot of emphasis on this UCC rule requiring specific description of collateral, right? He did. Now, this financing statement in the other side's appendix, so it doesn't give any information of value to a subsequent creditor, does it?
Well, that's exactly...
All assets, which presumably this is standard boilerplate. Tort claims, documents, general intangibles, supporting obligations, wherever located, with all accession, substitution, process, such.
As a
practical matter, what does a subsequent creditor do when he sees this?
That's exactly right. I think that the next step, if a creditor is to extend credit or...
I mean, this is a compliance statement, right?
It's a boilerplate financing statement. That's right.
What does the creditor do now?
The security agreement. And the security agreement is set up how it is.
Wait, look at the security agreement. Where is that?
The security agreement was the document that...
Oh, no, you're a creditor.
So you contact LaSalle
Bank. You look
LaSalle
at this
Bank,
thing. Now,
you
what
need
do you
to break
do?
This down into more steps.
Right. I suppose, well, you could do one of two things. You could contact the debtor and say, let me see your security agreement with that lender.
You CC, Laura. What do you do?
Well, I suppose I would... I would do is, if I was to, I would be doing as much as possible to determine the extent of that creditor's security interest, because I wouldn't want my client to stick his neck out in extending credit.
What would you do?
So I would call the bank and ask for a copy of the security agreement. And when I got it, I would see a blank Schedule B, no commercial tort claims listed, and I would say,
but you'd also
bingo.
See in the agreement that that LaSalle had a right to add that, you know, unilaterally at any time.
And I would say LaSalle clearly dropped the ball here.
Excuse me?
LaSalle dropped the ball.
Well, why wouldn't his subsequent creditor have dropped the ball if he said, look, I see you have this, you know, unilateral right and so on, but I don't see Schedule B. And, you know, what is the situation?
In this case, we already had our lien, so we said, you know, eureka. But
but I thought your co-counsel said that the answer to that, and I would like to know if this is right or wrong, is that as for commercial tort claims, the hypothetical creditor looking at this blank Schedule B can say, aha, I'm safe as to that, because if a later commercial tort claim is added, that's too late because of the way the UCC is structured for commercial tort claims, and that would be later acquired and therefore not under it. Is that at least your legal position?
And that's right. And Section 204 of the Article 9 is the after-acquired property clause, and it carves out commercial tort claims. And so you could get into a question of what do I know about commercial tort claims that are out there and currently exist. But no, that's right. I mean, if they aren't listed, then you, I would think, should be able to presume that they're not there because they don't yet exist, and that the lender would have exercised its right and protected its interest.
You argue any of that? Look, you filed two skinny briefs, not to be criticized for that, but they seem to be all about the Rothschild claim. Where's the stuff about the UC, this UCC's section that's requires specific description of commercial tort claim?
Well,
is it even cited in your briefs? Or?
I believe it is, Judge. In terms of where it is specifically, we obviously filed our brief in the main appeal focusing on that particular provision and the meaning of proceeds and what arising out of damage to collateral means. And the thought there being...
almost a complete blank.
Well...
One says arising under means this, the other says arising under means... It's this typical case, you're both arguing the plain meaning of basically meaningless language. Okay, well, we'll have to do our own research.
Thank you, Judge.
Okay, so thank you to both.